With an estimated 1,500 versions in the can, it's second only to the Beatles' Yesterday as the most recorded song ever. But for such a simple tune, Louie Louie has a complicated history. A song about love and loss written in the mid-50s would morph into a teenage anthem apparently so subversive it attracted the attentions of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. In time, Louie Louie would become the ultimate party song and feature in the repertoire of any garage band worth its salt. Along the way, those connected with it would experience success, scandal, and devastating failure. But Louie Louie would always come back for more. I'm Stevie Van Zandt, and you're listening to Louie and the G-Men.
On July the 2nd, 1953, I was serving time for armed robbery.
It all started in Los Angeles in the mid-50s. Back then, the West Coast music biz was buzzing. Local groups were harmonizing in every high school, and hustlers like the Bahari Brothers, the Mesners, Art Roop, and Dootsie Williams had kickstarted a new wave of independent record labels, like Specialty, Aladdin, Dutone, and Modern.
There's a ride going on. I've been cell block number 9.
There were more labels in the City of Angels than anywhere else in the United States, pumping out the best in doo-wop, blues, and R&B. And local record producers like Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller were taking the music into the big time. In 1954, they hired a local kid named Richard Berry to sing lead on their latest number, Riot and Cell Block Number 9. Still only 19 years old, Richard Berry was a gun for hire with talent to burn. Here's rock writer Dave Marsh.
Richard Berry was born in the early 30s, went to Jefferson High School in Los Angeles, which is the high school that produced all sorts of musicians, from the great Phil Spector singer Darlene Love to Johnny Guitar Watson, a lot of Hollywood doo-wop groups. And he spent a lot of time in the recording studios, particularly under the tutelage of Maxwell Davis, who was a saxophone player and arranger and producer for the Bahari Brothers at Modern Records.
He was a good songwriter.
Modern Records boss, Joe Bahari.
He brought in most of the groups for us to record, and he was a part of a lot of them.
He wants to rock.
What can I do? I'll rock with you. Come on, let's do.
The Flares. She Wants to Rock. That was the first doo-wop record or a group record that we recorded that had any meaning to it whatsoever.
I'll tell you a story that's never been told about this girl who was so bold. She used to get up and rock and go to bed on the same. I'll never forget, it was a crying shame.
She wants to rock.
All night long.
The 50s was a boom time for radio, too. This was the golden era of personality DJs, and Los Angeles had some of the best.
There was a disc jockey in L.A. that was very popular with R&B music. His name was Hunter Hancock.
That's Orange County band leader Barry Rieta.
He was a white man, but he was playing all the latest R&B records that were popular, and he would have people phone in and vote on their record of the week.
Let's go hunting with Hunter.
Came to Los Angeles from Texas, where he grew up. And what he found in Los Angeles was a R&B movement that was looking for a voice.
Good hunting, everybody. This is Hunter Hancock, old HH, getting ready to do a little hunting around with some of the very best in rhythm and blues records, featuring principally the greatest and most popular Negro musicians, singers, entertainers in the world.
Really, two disc jockeys in Los Angeles fulfilled that role, and they were both white. Dick Hugg, who was known as Huggy Boy, and Hunter Hancock. And each of them did sort of the same thing, is they broadcast on behalf of a record store from the window of the record store late at night or in the evenings, and they played the R&B hits of the day.
Records which are the tops in popularity all around the country, along with some of the newer records whose popularity will be determined by you, the listener. So now, if everybody's ready, let's go hunting with Hunter.
But Angelinos weren't just digging doo-wop and R&B. Latin American rumbas, mambos, and cha-chas were lapped up by local crowds. On Sunday nights, Richard Berry would hook up with a 12-piece orchestra, the Rhythm Rockers, for its regular spot at the Harmony Park Ballroom in Anaheim. The band was fronted by brothers Ricky and Barry Rieta.
It was a great classic ballroom. It was all wooden, great acoustics, 400 to 500 capacity. A great stage area, maybe 3 to 4 feet high, bench seating all along the walls. We would do all the R&B records. Then we would throw in some Latin music to satisfy our crowd.
Richard Berry's girlfriend, Dorothy Adams, was a Sunday night regular.
Everybody was dancing to the cha-cha-cha. Out at the Harmony Park Ballroom, the cha-cha-cha was it.
As the Rhythm Rockers warmed up the crowd with some hot Latino numbers, Richard took his usual seat backstage.
While I was in the back of the dressing room waiting for them to call me up on stage, they were doing this real way out Latin riff. It was that don't 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 don't. And immediately I said, hey man, that's it. Louie 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 Louie. But that's all I could come up with.
Being with Richard, I was always backstage. And I remember when Ricky Rilera played this cha-cha thing that they played, that Richard liked it, and he was patting his feet. He said, I like that note. And then he, dun dun dun, dun 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 dun. He said, I'm going to write this down on a napkin. So he had a napkin back then, he wrote the notes down. And he never got that out of his head.
So the next day I went out and I bought the record, which was a record called El Loco Cha-Cha by Rene Tuzet. And they had that hook right there the same way, you know, and that's how Louie Louie began to form.
He used to keep a recorder by the bed so that if he got a tune in his head in the middle of the night, he would get up and working with it to try to come up with the lyrics and then finish it the next day.
Richard was working on some lyrics about a young man who, missing his girl back home, pours out his heart to the bartender who's pouring him a drink. For inspiration, he checked out a couple of classic Twilight tearjerkers. First up, old Blue Eyes himself.
The particular Frank Sinatra late night thing was a song called Set 'Em Up Joe, which is best known by its alternate title, which is in the chorus, which is called One for My Baby and One More for the Road.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know.
It's just a guy in a bar missing his girlfriend and trying to figure a way to get back together with her in the middle of the night. What Richard did was he imagined a Jamaican sailor in the same situation. And Louis the bartender, we don't know the sailor's name. We don't even know the girlfriend's name.
Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
Another favorite was Chuck Berry's Story of Love Under the Cuban Skies.
Havana moon, Havana moon, me all alone with a jug of rum, me stand and wait for boat to come. It's long the night, it's quiet the dark, did boat she late since 12 o'clock.
I guess the real story about Louie Louie is this guy talking to someone that he knew, maybe like in a bar or on the street. Could have been a taxi cab driver, anything, you know. But he was telling him, hey, man, I got to go. I got this fine little girl waiting for me, and I got to catch this ship so I can see her.
For his next record date, Richard checked into the Hollywood Recorders on Santa Monica Boulevard. With him was a young vocal group from Jefferson High called the Pharaohs. Together, they laid down four tracks, including the hot off the presses, Louie Louie. Flip Records released the new Richard Berry and the Pharaohs single in April of 1957. Louie Louie only made it to the B-side. The lead track was Richard's take on a good old country standard.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Richard had recorded Louie Louie for Max Beiertag at Flip Records, and Max basically said, I don't want you to do that. The A-side is your version of You Are My Sunshine, which is a classic American song, probably not even in copyright. So Richard just kind of threw Louie Louie on the B-side of this thing. Well, Hunter Hancock flipped it over.
You're listening to the best in rhythm and blues records, heard every night, Monday through Saturday, from 6 to 9 p.m. on the original 24-hour station, KGFJ, Los Angeles.
Thing we thought was, wow, this is very, very smooth and very polished.
Barry Rieta.
It was more like a Caribbean-influenced rhythm, but still with that R&B pulse to it.
I liked it because of the beat, but I never dreamed that song was going to be a great big smash hit.
Dorothy Adams.
It played locally for a long time, and then, of course, it did go big on the West Coast. It broke in some other states, but we never even dreamed that song was going to be that big.
Louie Louie climbed up the local charts, eventually selling over 100,000 copies. But Richard Berry was broke and working at a record pressing plant to make ends meet. He was going to need the money. He just proposed to Dorothy, and she'd said yes, but with one condition.
I was young. I was 16 years old when we got married. And I wanted to have a wedding ring set to show my friends that I had gotten married, okay? And he had told me he was going to get it, but at the time he couldn't afford it, and he was going to save some money to get it, but he wanted to get married anyway. He said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to sell some songs, and then I'll get the ring. And he sold Louie Louie for $700 to Mr. Firetog at Flip Records. And Richard bought my ring set.
He didn't get $750 for Louie Louie. Louie Louie by itself would have been lucky to get $75 for her. So he sold a whole bundle of songs.
Dave Marsh.
He sells things he wrote before Louie Louie. He sells things he wrote after Louie Louie. The people who had record companies and publishing companies had all the capital, and advantage was taken.
So Richard sold the rights to Louie Louie, got hitched, and waited patiently for some other song of his to make it. It would be a long time coming. Louie Louie had been and gone, and was gathering dust in the bargain bin. Richard tried to recreate the magic, but without success. Meanwhile, far from the hustle of downtown L.A., way up the coast in the Pacific Northwest, a new kind of rock and roll was bubbling under. Separated from the main music centers on the coast, groups in the Northwest were developing their own unique sound.
An important factor in the emergence of the Northwest sound was the military bases that were on the western sides of the state.
That's Seattle-based writer Peter Blecka.
You had a lot of military personnel, soldiers, sailors, and so forth, that weren't from the Pacific Northwest. They came from other states, from other areas with their own musical traditions. And when they were drafted into the military or joined in the military, we're talking World War II here and then Korea, they brought the musical taste with them. So, you know, subtle pressure was put on the musicians in the area to play music that would entertain these newcomers, and they wanted rhythm and blues.
You know I feel all right.
Yeah.
You know I feel all right, children.
Yeah.
I feel all right.
Bill Haley and his Comets came through in 1956, and Elvis Presley and his trio came through in 1957, and they played three or four towns. They would play Tacoma, Seattle, Vancouver, BC, Spokane, maybe Portland, and then they'd be on their way.
And believe me, I'm a person. And believe me, I'm
a... You suddenly had James Brown and the Famous Flames, you had Little Junior Parker, you had Bobby Blue Bland, and Richard Berry came through on one of those tours and brought Louie Louie with him.
In Tacoma, Washington, school friends Buck Ormsby and Bill Englehart were regulars at downtown dance hall, the Evergreen Ballroom.
Bill and I would go into this place and we'd go up. The stage is only about 3 feet high off the ground. And there was a bar rail around it. And we'd go up and grab onto that bar and we'd stay there. We weren't moving, man, because Ray Charles was going to come out, you know. And I got to see Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and James Brown and the Famous Flames and Mike and Tina Turner and the I-Cats. I mean, it just inspired the heck out of me, and I couldn't believe that we had the opportunity to see these artists that were not really recognized by white audiences.
You gotta live for yourself, yourself and nobody else. You gotta live for yourself, yourself and nobody else.
Buck and Bill had got the bug and wasted no time in putting together their own group, the Blue Notes, with Buck on bass and Bill on guitar and vocals. Then one day, they found themselves a natural-born frontman with plenty of attitude.
Little Bill and I were walking down this fairway, and we saw this kid standing on this bench. And there was a bunch of people standing in front of him. We thought he was giving a political speech or something, because he looked like a geek. He was a real bookworm kind of guy, you know, and we thought, well, the closer we got, we heard this singing, and the guy was singing rock and roll songs to these crowds a cappella, you know. And I mean, we walk up there and we go, wow, you know, that was and he was so good, you know, and these people were just enamored with him. And Bill and I walked up to him after, you know, he kind of stopped, and we said, hey, you know, you want to sing in a rock and roll band, because he was that good.
In 1959, the Blue Notes' first record, I Love an Angel, reached number 20 on the Billboard charts. But the band wasn't built to last. In time, Little Bill would strike out on his own, while Buck and Rockin' Robin hooked up with the Northwest's biggest act, the Wailers. The Wailers were legends in the Northwest. As high school kids, they'd scored a national hit with the instrumental Tall Cool One, and the group was gigging regularly at venues like the Spanish Castle on Highway 99. The band featured two of the greatest musicians of the era, guitarist Rich Dangel and drummer Mick Burke.
There was another artist in Seattle. His name was Ron Holden. And he had a hit called Love You So. Darling, I love you so. And it was a great song.
I love you so.
Put together a band, and we performed at this event, and he sang the song Louie Louie, and Robin, our singer, heard it, He said, wow, that's something maybe we should work on. So Robin went and found it in a bin in his record store for a dime and found the record, got the words, got the music and everything. He and Rich Dandrell, our guitar player at the time, put together a rock and roll version of it.
The entire climate of the song, the entire music of the song is transformed.
Dave Marsh.
It's hard to think of another song that's ever had two lives that are so very, very different.
Richard took three chords. That was the original Richard Berry. That's the way they did it. So he went. Took the same chords, rearranged it the way he wanted to hear it. And, of course, that's the way that Robin sang. So it kind of melded real nice together. You know, he had to get into a groove with it, and he did.
I said, Louie, Louie, oh, well, I said, we gotta go. We find little girl, she waits for me.
You played Louie, Louie, and you had 100% of those people dancing. I mean, it would draw out of the woodwork. It was so popular. That was the reason why we made a decision that that would be the first single on our label.
Hello, hello, yeah, 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 I said, we gotta go. Oh, oh, said, hello, hello, well, baby, we gotta go.
Robin just was so dynamic on stage, and I was so surprised because he looked so geeky, you know, and wore the glasses. I mean, sort of like a Buddy Holly guy. You'd think it would just stand there, but I mean, when he got on stage, he was a totally different person. He was moving on stage and singing so great, and he would ad lib.
No, no, we gotta go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he added all. That was the way that Robin worked, you know. He added the yeah, yeah, yeahs, and then right before the solo, he says, let's give it to him right now, you know.
Let's give it to him right now.
Transformed the cool calypso of Richard Berry's Louie Louie into gritty garage band rock and roll. Local audiences loved it, and the single became a massive regional hit.
If we could be like the Wailers, if we could just be as big as they are, that would have made us all happy. All the groups felt that way. So wherever the Wailers went, you had to see if you could copy or emulate what they would do. So everybody learned from the Wailers, and the one great tune we all learned was Louie Louie.
Yours truly, Kissin' Radio.
Back in the early 60s, Roger Hart was a DJ at KISN, the top radio station in Portland, Oregon. Ken Chase was Kissin's music director. And another one of the station's star turns.
It was an AM station. In those days, there was no FM, you know. There was FM, but nobody would listen to it because it was strictly jazz and elevator music and that sort of thing. We had a 50% share oftentimes. That's a huge, huge amount of people listening to, even in a small market.
And as Ken Chase explains, DJs were big enough names to stage their own dances in local clubs.
The station allowed us to have 30 spots a week, gratis, to promote ourselves and to do such things. We would go out on Saturday night and have a sock hop. The first one was in a little town called Scappoose, Oregon. And we would take a little rock and roll band, or we would have a single turntable and a couple of speakers, and we would play music and the kids would dance. We finally opened a teenage nightclub called The Chase.
The mix of hit records and live music was irresistible, and Chase was on the lookout for a band to work his club five nights a week.
We had a battle of the bands at the Memorial Coliseum with thousands and thousands of kids come to the battle of the bands. And a three-piece group of guys called the Jazz Masters brought the house down with a song called Louie Louie. I picked them up as the house band, and we would go out to these auditoriums, these armories, these sock hops. They would play a couple of songs, and then I would play a half a dozen records, and then I'd bring them back, and they would play another couple of songs, and then I'd play some more records. Well, every time the band came back on, the kids would yell, "Louie, Louie! Louie, Louie! Louie, Louie!"
Seeing the effect that Louie, Louie had on his audiences, Ken Chase reckoned it was time for the Jazz Masters to get the magic down on tape.
The day before they were supposed to go into the studio, they got the jitters, and they started fighting amongst each other, and they broke up. So once they broke up, we needed another house band, and many of the other bands around town tried out because they knew it was a winning spot.
The Raiders were the hottest act to come out of the Northwest since the heyday of the Wailers. Formed in Boise, Idaho, they were led by Paul Revere.
I used to set my piano on fire every night. You know, I'd buy these upright pianos for $50, have them taken to the hall. I'd stuff the inside of the thing, certain areas of it that I didn't have to play on, where the notes didn't have to be perfect. I'd have stuffed paper in there, and I'd throw a match down there and set the things on fire. The thing would be blazing. We'd put it out with the fire extinguisher. We'd tip it over. We was doing the Who before the Who was the Who.
With their flamboyant stage act and musical virtuosity, Paul Revere and the Raiders had no trouble in packing out halls throughout the region.
Every little town had its own little rock and roll station, and you'd go rent the local armory. You'd get an armory for $30 to $50 for a night, and that's nothing for a Friday or Saturday night. Hello. You'd get the number one DJ at the radio station, say, "Dude, you got to come out and introduce us, promote the dance that's coming up in 2 weeks, make it a big deal." It was shooting fish in a barrel. It was like coming to a town with a brand new product called candy.
The Raiders had already scored a couple of regional hits with the instrumentals Beatnik Sticks and Like Long Hair, and seemed a safe bet to land the gig as house band at the Chase.
We were tossing around Paul Revere and Raiders, but they, let's put it this way, Paul Revere and the Raiders drank beer. That's terrible in those days. It was a terrible thing. So we couldn't have that. And they drove a hearse. That's what they called their equipment around. So we chose, simply because they were clean cut, nice church going boys. They were just model citizens. We picked the Kingsmen.
Fronted by Jack Ely, the Kingsmen were a group of school friends from Portland, Oregon, who practiced in their drummer's basement and grabbed gigs wherever they could. One of the regular stops on the local teen circuit was a place called the Pipo Club down on the coast in Seaside, Oregon.
One time we had played there on a Friday and Saturday, and we didn't pack up our equipment Saturday night because we wanted to go party with the local kids. So we were in the Pipo Club on a Sunday afternoon, probably 1 o'clock or so, packing up all our equipment. And there were probably at least a half a dozen, maybe more, kids up there who were sitting at tables and drinking Cokes and busily doing their homework for Monday morning, you know. And somebody got up and put a quarter in the jukebox. Well, in those days, a quarter would buy you 10 songs. Every other song he played was Louie Louie by the Wailers. Even though we were busily packing up our stuff, I started noticing that every time this Louie Louie song came on, the kids would get up and stand by their chairs and dance. They couldn't stay seated. Louie Louie, well, I'll say, you gotta go. On Tuesday at school, I asked some of my black friends, "Hey, where do you guys get your records?" "Well, we get our records at this little record shop out in the colored district called Bop City Music." So after school, I get in my car, I drive out to Bop City Music, and I ask the guy, I said, "Do you have a record named Louie Louie?" He goes, "Yeah." "Who do you want it by?" I said, "Is it by more than one person?" "Yeah." Within 2 seconds of listening to Richard Berry and the Pharaohs version, I knew that wasn't the one I wanted. So then they gave me the Wailers, and I said, "Yeah, that's it." So I bought the record. So by the time I got to rehearsal on Wednesday, I knew the guitar parts. I had learned the words because I had listened to the song. And no one else had even heard the song, because they hadn't been able to find the record.
The Kingsmen's own peculiar take on Louie Louie became a highlight of their gigs at the Chase, and the band was soon pestering the boss for a record date. What finally persuaded Ken was the night in April 63 when the King's Men played nothing but Louie Louie and the crowd still wanted more. Jack Ealy.
I think we ended up playing it probably for about 40 minutes one night. Of course, for a whole year before that, almost every week I'd been bugging Ken. Ken, look what this song does. We got to record it. What are we waiting for? Oh, you're not ready yet. You're not ready. But then we did this marathon thing, and after that he was convinced.
So convinced that he booked time at the Northwest Recorders in downtown Portland for a session the very next day. This is Little Steven, and you're listening to Louie and the G-Men on 88 to 91 FM, Radio 2 from the BBC.
Ken's idea was to set us up in a circle, all facing in towards each other, and all our amplifiers facing in towards each other, and then put a mic up by the ceiling on a boom and have that suspended down in the middle of this circle that was probably 15 feet in diameter. Then I would stand in the middle of the circle and yell up at the mic. And he felt that by doing that, he would capture the essence of the live sound that we had in his club.
The bass was the driving beat in the song. The words were not important at all, and so I didn't really put a close mic, what you would call close mic, Jack Ealy, who sang the song. In fact, I put the microphone on a boom clear up in the ceiling, and I told him to scream at that microphone.
In the production booth, Chase was joined by the studio's resident engineer, Bob Lindahl, more accustomed to recording radio commercials than rock and roll.
This voice came over the microphone into the sound room where we were. Start playing a little bit, you guys. We started playing, and we could see through the glass what was happening in the booth. And all of a sudden, I saw Lindahl reach over in front of Chase and pull his hand away from the board. And there ensued what looked to us, even though we couldn't hear it, an argument going on in there. And all of a sudden, we saw Lindahl leave the booth.
He was an old-time engineer. And the way that engineers did things in those days is that you set the levels and then you told the band to play. He didn't realize that you could fiddle, as he called it. You know, you can fiddle with the knobs once we get it set. And I said, Bob, this is my session, and this is my instrument, and this is what I'm going to play. And when the band is playing, I'm going to adjust the volumes, you see. Oh, he didn't think that. No, you can't do that. You'll wreck my board.
And suddenly Ken's voice came in. Okay, now, you guys, I want you to just run through Louie Louie. Let's do it right now. So Donnie starts the song, and we play it.
The band was blasting its way through the song when drummer Lynn Easton fluffed one of his fills.
He was doing one of those funny runs that he does where he runs around all the drums and hits a cymbal at the same time where he goes, you know, and one of his sticks, instead of hitting the face of the drum head, went clank on the metal rim of the drum. And you can hear this, ah, in the background. I'm not going to say what he said. See the door to the booth open and Lindahl comes in. And we found out later that Lindahl had said, you can't do that, you can't have those levels, you're going to blow up my equipment. And then things calmed down for a minute and Ken said, why don't you get us some coffee? And when Lindahl went out to get him some coffee, he locked the door and locked him out of the booth. We played the song, Lindahl came back in, it was too late, it was all done.
Hey,
the amazement of the King's men, Ken Chase declared himself delighted with the band's performance and suggested they get on with recording a B-side.
I said, that's it. That's the cut right there. That's exactly what I wanted. And they said, no, you can't use that recording. It's got a mistake in it. And I said, you know what? Doesn't matter. The recording that we got, even though it had a mistake in it, it had the sound that I wanted. And I said, it's a hit.
If this really was the sound Ken Chase was after, he was way ahead of his time. The King's Men's Louie Louie was punk rock before punk rock had even been invented. Convinced he had something special in the can, Chase rushed back to the radio station and told Roger Hart that he just recorded his first hit record.
I was pumped because I knew I had it in the can. I knew this was the hit record. This is the sound. This is exactly what the kids would dance to. So I went back to the radio station. I walked in the front door, and Roger was walking out. And I said, told Roger, I said, I have just got the greatest hit of all time. This is fantastic.
Like Ken, Roger Hart was promoting his own teen dances in downtown Portland. But unlike Chase, he'd hired Paul Revere and Raiders to be his house band. And just like the King's Men at the Chase Club, the Raiders knew that to fill the dance floor, all they had to do was break into the Northwest national anthem, Louie Louie.
These kids would all get in a big, I called them a sandwich. I mean, they'd all just line up. They'd all just move to the rhythm of Louie Louie. It would probably scare parents half to death. There'd be sandwiches all over the dance floor. Some of the sandwiches would be made up of 30, 40 people at a time, but they would move to the rhythm.
You could do Louie Louie. The place would really bounce. We could play other things, and it was bouncing. But Louie Louie, you could bring it back every third song. There was something about the beat that just brought this fervor out. And it was a given that we've got to do that.
We had $50 for an hour, and we cut Louie Louie and Night Train.
Paul Revere.
And we used a Wurlitzer electric piano. Those things were so always out of tune. They were the worst. But they had a nasty kind of sound to them. I like that sound. The saxophone was, that was Mark. And Mike Smitty goes, grab your woman, it's Louie Louie time.
Grab your woman, it's Louie Louie time.
That was something we used to do at our dances every night. You know, as soon as we'd go into it, the kids would roar out on the dance floor, and Smitty would yell on his microphone back at the drum, grab you a woman, it's Louie Louie time.
Louie Louie, yeah, brother, yeah, Austin, I'm gonna go now. Yeah, 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 yeah. Louie Louie, oh, no, Austin, I'm gonna go now. Oh, yeah, the fine little girl, she waits for me.
Now there were two versions of Louie Louie ready to roll in the Northwest. Roger Hart and Ken Chase went looking for a way to get their versions released. And as Jack Ely recalls, Chase was the first out of the blocks.
Because of Ken being the music director at Kissin', he had records sent to him from all different kinds of distribution point companies. And one of the distribution point companies was a little company up in Seattle called Craig Corporation. And they handled a bunch of different labels. Well, through Craig Corporation, Ken had met Jerry Denon, who was one of their reps. And Jerry had confided in Ken that he had started his own label.
He said, would you consider putting a record out on the Kingsmen? It didn't take me long. He said, I know we can sell 500 copies. And I said, yes. I don't think I really was sitting there, wow, this is really going to be a big hit. Once it got on the air in Portland, it got great reception to Ken Chase and Kissin's airplay. So I knew between the past history of Louie Louie with the Wailers that we had the right ingredients.
As the station's music director, Ken Chase was able to make the King's Men's 45 KISN's pick hit of the week, guaranteeing the record airplay on the hour every hour for 7 days. But this move went down badly with station owner Don Burden.
You know what? It hit the fan. I suppose it could have been construed as plug-ola. I don't know. I suppose it could have been that. But He certainly was not happy with me. There's a lot of things happened after that.
But thanks to Ken Chase's airplay, the Kingsmen's Louie Louie became a decent-sized hit in the Northwest. But it was the Paul Revere version, released on Roger Hart's Sandy label, that really took off. Jerry Denon was having trouble convincing his contacts to get behind the Kingsmen's 45.
We were kind of a brethren on a national basis. Somebody in Los Angeles, somebody in Miami, somebody in Boston, what have you. And I sent the pressing off to people like me in other markets who basically laughed at me and insulted me and thought, you know, Jerry, we like you, but this is a joke. You know, we can't get that thing on the air. So we had to go through all of that. But I knew, okay, it's like test marketing. I knew it was successful. We just hadn't gotten there yet. And thank God for Boston.
Barney Ginsburg, the guy with the swinging show. Down in Boston, Mass, he's the guy that the kids all know.
The biggest disc jockey in Boston was Arnie Woo Woo Ginsburg. The star of station WMEX, Ginsburg was a local legend who could make or break a 45. Jack Ely.
What he did was he played the worst record and the best record that he'd received that week. So he played Louie Louie as the worst record he had gotten that week. But he prefaced it by saying, this is not only the worst record I've gotten this week, this is the worst record I've ever gotten. And he played Louie Louie by us. Immediately, before the song was even over, the switchboard was lit up. Every line was busy. Where can we get that record? Play it again, will you?
My distributor friend called up and said, my goodness, I need records. You know, I need 1,000 in here. Well, I don't have 1,000. So originally I would go and get them pressed, but I didn't have any money. I was just a guy who worked for a living. And so when the record really started happening and he was asking for quantities I couldn't deliver, I had to find a home for it.
The Kingsmen single was eventually reissued on the Scepter Wand label and started to break out across the U.S. And then, suddenly, the Louie Louie saga got even stranger. Long before stories of spinning records backwards to hear the sound of Satan or Tipper Gore's parental advisory stickers, word got out that someone at Northwest Recorders had hatched a dastardly plan. Louie Louie was recorded in such a way that if you slowed the 45 down to 33 and a third, the real words would emerge as if by magic. And these were no innocent lyrics about missing some girl across the sea. These were about longings of a more primal kind.
Some kids at Miami of Ohio University somehow call the governor of Indiana, which is the next state to the west,
Dave Marsh.
And they tell him that there are all these bad words. It's about sex and teenage sex at that. And that governor, good Democrat that he was, sent a memo to every radio station in the state, told them to take it off the air. Well, of course they did, but the news of the memo hit the Associated Press wire and got all around the country.
The rumor snowballed and children were trying to decipher those lyrics and trying to write the lyrics down and passing notes.
Peter Blecka.
And so the legend goes, some teachers somewhere confiscated those little notes being passed in class between kids, and they were horrified to see what the kids were writing, and it took on a life of its own. It was a moment of paranoia that could have been solved with some focused research into the thing, like really listening to the record closely once might have solved it.
The grown-ups of the time didn't understand the words because they couldn't listen that long. They just hated it. They just hated what it sounded like. They weren't going to... It's like people with hip-hop records now. They got no idea what anybody's saying. I could tell people that the new Public Enemy record has Chuck D reciting the Ten Commandments. They wouldn't doubt me. They'd have to go listen to the record. Same thing.
But according to Ken Chase, the story was much more than a harmless college prank. Darker forces were at work. His boss at KISN Radio had been dead against his support for the Kingsmen. As far as Chase is concerned, Don Burden was prepared to go to any lengths to kill their record.
Don was a political kind of guy, and he knew the governor of Indiana quite well. So he picked up the phone, and he called the governor of Indiana and got the record banned in Indiana. He thought that would just really fit my goat. He also had one of the secretaries write a letter to the attorney general. That would be Mr. Kennedy. And say that she wanted this thing investigated and that we should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Whatever the source of the story about Louie's dirty lyrics, it was being taken seriously. As outraged parents throughout the land became convinced that they heard Jack Ely singing about sin, the FBI moved in to protect the nation's morals.
If you're going to research a pornographic record, you have to go to the band that recorded it. So they went to the Kingsmen and chased them down. They tracked them across the country, according to the boys in the band, and at numerous dance dates and concert dates, the Kingsmen recall seeing, you know, sunglasses wearing natty-suited FBI agents watching the band play. And in fact, they did contact the band and pull them down for an interview, gave them the third degree, I think, in some hotel ballroom. It was all around the question of what are the lyrics to your record.
We got a call saying there were some people from the federal government who wanted to come see me.
Jerry Denon.
We had representatives of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, that walked in my office door one day, and I think there were two or three of them. And it was all, you know, very surreal because they looked like it was out of a bad movie. They had their hats on and their suits and their trench coats, and they wanted to know about this Louie and how we did that. And I tried to explain. There was nothing that was done. It was all just a big imagination on a lot of people's part. It was very frightening.
The G-Men spent 30 months and thousands of tax dollars in their pursuit of Louie. Agents in six major cities pored over pages of lyrics and listened to master tapes at every speed possible. But not once did they speak to two of the story's main players, the man who sang on the Kingsmen's record, Jack Ely, and the man who recorded it, Ken Chase.
I thought it was odd that they weren't knocking on my door, since I was the one who sang it. You know, it's like, you have all this testimony from people in the record industry that weren't there when we recorded it. How can you say you've had an investigation? I don't know. It just didn't make sense to me.
It's suspect. You think that the man who recorded it in the studio, the man who could have somehow altered the record to have dirty records if played at the wrong speed and all, they didn't even talk to me?
The G-Men finally gave up the ghost in October 66, concluding that no matter how hard they listened, Louie was unintelligible at any speed. The unintended effect of the G-Men's pursuit of Louie was to guarantee its success. As Dave Marsh explains, by January 1964, it was heading for the top of the Billboard chart.
Now you've got a banned song. A banned song, you can start minting money off that. Now it's going to get five times the airplay it ever would have gotten, which actually probably more like 5,000 times. And it just becomes a thing. It becomes like a teenage thing.
Louie now became a blueprint for bands in the early 60s, and its influence can be heard in some of the key songs of the British Invasion. Check out You Really Got Me by The Kinks, or The Who's I Can't Explain. But Richard Berry wasn't getting much in return. Since selling his rights to buy his fiancée a wedding ring, he looked on with a mixture of amazement and despair as Louie became a legend. When work dried up on the club circuit, Richard was forced to go on welfare.
We searched him out down in South L.A. We found out where he was working, in a piano bar, and Paul and Mark Lindsay and I, and I think one of the other Raiders, went into this bar, and we found him. He was marginally suicidal, not truly, but, you know, despondent over all his losses. There were some rough times.
Chuck Rubin had been around musicians for years through his work as a booking agent. He'd heard a thousand sob stories from clients about music business ripoffs, so he decided to do something about it. In 1977, he set up the Artists' Rights Enforcement Corporation to hunt down the missing money. Early successes included winning back rights for the Shirelles and Wilbur Harrison. And as Louie took on yet another new lease of life, Richard Berry got in touch.
The opportunity for Louie to really take off after all of its early successes was the film Animal House. It seemed that Louie was the essence of the raucous, party, youth-oriented exuberance. and it just took off.
Excuse me, sir, is this the Delta House?
Sure. Come on in.
When that occurred, that I think is what triggered Richard to finally make that call.
Chuck Rubin looked into the history of Richard Berry's dealings with Max Feartag at Limex Music and filed a claim.
Just by sheer coincidence, at the time that the claim was presented, an opportunity for a huge commercial came about, which was some kind of a sweet wine drink that was all the rage back in the early 80s. And they wanted to use Louie Louie, which they felt was the party song, to present the wine cooler campaign to kick it off. The advertising agency said they wanted to do this, but as long as there was this claim, they felt awkward and uncomfortable about doing it.
A quarter of a century after he'd written Louie Louie, Richard Berry's ship finally came in.
We actually got back half of the copyright and all of his songwriting income. And as a result of that and the California Cooler commercial and a variety of other things that happened, Richard's life, of course, changed economically, and so did the effect of Louie Louie on the international scene as well.
Back in the early 1980s, Stretch Rydell was DJing at KFJC, a college station in California.
What I often did was I would do the entire show out of my own record collection, which at the time consisted of about 5,000 or 6,000 albums. So I'd just sit in my library at home, and I'd pull a couple hundred records and take them all up to the station and do my show. Well, after doing that for a while, I started thinking about themes. And I started thinking, well, what song do I have in my collection, you know, more than one or two versions of? I looked through all my records, and I ended up with 33 versions of Louie Louie, which to me was a lot. So I said, heck, I'm going to play them all at once. And it lasted an hour and a half.
And now, the news.
Stretch was onto something. And in August 1983, he and some like-minded colleagues unleashed KFJC's Maximum Louie Marathon. In the course of 63 hours, they played over 800 versions of the song.
This next version of Louie Louie, and we will be playing Louie Louie all weekend. I'm sure you're aware by now, this is Maximum Louie. This is Phil Dirt with you and Stretch, and we've got Richard Berry here for the entire weekend. He will be performing live with Lady Bo, who backed Bo Diddley whenever he's in town, tomorrow at 3 o'clock on KFJC, and we have lots of other live bands, too. This next version of Louie Louie is from the Beach Boys. Any special notes here?
Just the Beach Boys doing Louie Louie on KFJC.
Louie Louie was now one of the most recorded songs of all time and an indelible part of American popular culture. It was only a matter of time before someone approached Richard Berry about making it an official anthem.
He was asked to come up to the state of Washington.
Chuck Rubin.
There was a political drive to have Louie Louie nominated as the state song. And so Richard became a politician for about 6 months, lobbying for the song and meeting with these people or these politicians in order to see if the song could be the state song. I don't think that it did make it, but he certainly enjoyed that as well.
In Tacoma, one of the song's earliest champions, Buck Ormsby of the Wailers, reckoned Louie had global potential too.
There was this event that took place here with drummers, and they called it Woodstick. And they had 500 drummers. And they had certain songs that they did to play along with all these drummers, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, why don't we do a thing with Louie Louie and get as many guitar players as we can and break a Guinness World Records with the most guitars playing Louie Louie all at once in the same place. We called it Louis Fest. And we had about 700 guitar players the first time. It's a festival now that's been running for 4 years. We can connect either through computers or satellite or even with a phone, you know. And I think we can connect the whole damn world with that one song.
Richard Berry died in 1997, 40 years after bringing Louie into the world and having at last reaped its due rewards. As Louie has gotten older, so the layers of the story have continued to grow. But one thing has remained constant, a song about nothing much at all. It contains rock and roll's most important ingredients, simplicity, excitement, and the ability to outrage. And because of that, and the magic of that simple da-da-da, da 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 da, Louis will live forever.
I said, me gotta go, Louis, me gotta go.
I'm Little Steven. Louis and the G-Men was produced by Owen McFadden. Until the next time, me gotta go now.
I said, me gotta go, Louis.
On 88 to 91 FM, this is Radio 2 from the BBC.